Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two guests today. In moments, we'll hear from Vincent Bevins, author of The Jakarta Method, about the U.S.-backed strategy of mass killing of communists and other leftists who threatened the rule of Washington and Wall Street. And then the educator Kyle Beckham will talk about schooling in this hellscape. A brief economic update. The carnage in the job market continues. On Thursday morning, the Labor Department reported that 2.4 million people applied for unemployment benefits during the week ending May 16th, bringing the total for the last 9 weeks to just under 39 million. That's about a quarter of the total employed at the onset of the crisis. As of the week before, the most recent available, 25 million were drawing benefits, substantially fewer than that sum of applicants. The processing machinery is obsolete and underfunded and so unable to keep up with the torrent. Additionally, 2.2 million people applied for the special pandemic benefits offered to those who wouldn't be normally eligible, like freelancers or those with short employment histories. I wouldn't be at all surprised to see the official unemployment rate hit 25% when the May numbers are released on June 4th. Interestingly, Politico reported on Thursday that Georgia, one of the states most aggressively opening up, as they say, hasn't seen any economic kick from the strategy. It has the highest ratio of applications for unemployment insurance to employment of all the states. It's not the restrictions so much as the disease. Despite some highly publicized exceptions, most people don't want to risk their lives by going out for pizza and a haircut. And now to another cheerful topic, mass terror. Vincent Bevins is a veteran foreign correspondent who's written for the LA Times and Washington Post, among other outlets. His book, The Jakarta Method, Washington's Anti-Communist Crusade and the Mass Murder Program That Shaped Our World, is just out from Public Affairs Books. In 1965, the U.S., working with the Indonesian military, engineered a coup against a humane and decent leader, Sukarno, and replaced him with a vicious dictator, Suharto, who proceeded to run a program of mass murder that resulted in the death of almost 1 million civilians. From Washington's point of view, the model was a ringing success and was duplicated in nearly 20 countries around the world, mainly in Asia and Latin America. Indonesia's death toll tops the charts, but there are over 300,000 killed in Central America, 300,000 in East Timor, and close to 100,000 in South America. Vincent Bevins' book is the story of that strategy, one that shaped the world we live in today, even though it was mostly over by the mid-90s. Vincent Bevins. You've lived in two of the places, at least, that you've read about at length, Brazil and Indonesia. Are the historical events really palpable to someone living there day to day all these years later, or is it just sort of blended into the background?
In Indonesia, it's very palpable. It is still illegal to defend communism or to tell the truth about what happened back in 1965. In Brazil, it wasn't that palpable until very recently, when the Red Scare ideology is now the official ideology of the country. I mean, it's really back in an obvious way.
And of course, Bolsonaro himself admires a coup, right?
Well, Bolsonaro's entire 30-year political career until he ran for president was saying that the dictatorship shouldn't have ended, that it should have killed more communists, and that you could never improve Brazil with democracy. So he is the full embodiment of the resurrection of the ideology that powered 20th century South American dictatorships.
Okay, let's go back to the history now. Initially, back in 48, Truman and people around him talked about the Jakarta Axiom. What was that all about?
So when the United States exited World War II as by far the most powerful country in the world, they knew what to do with their allies in the First World, which was to help them and be friends to them. They decided in the first couple of years of the post-war era what they would do with the Second World, the Soviet Union, that they would confront them and try to roll them back or contain them. But they didn't really know how to deal with the Third World. And Sukarno became the axiomatic case of a leader that you could deal with even though they were not technically your full ally. So the fact that in 1948 the communists did not gain control of the revolution to expel the Dutch, the fact that Sukarno allowed for the repression of the Communist Party and created this new parliamentary multi-party democracy was the case that defined the Truman era policy that, well, as long as they're neutral and the communists don't seem like they're about to take power, we can work with them.
And a bit more about Sukarno himself. I mean, he had leftish leanings, anti-colonial, but not aligned at all with the Soviet Union, right?
Yes, never aligned with the Soviet Union up until the very end. So he grew up out of the anti-Dutch colonial movement in ways which we might find really surprising now, kind of brought everyone together. So the The communists worked with the non-communist Marxists, who worked with the Islamists, who worked with the liberals and the nationalists. He was very much a syncretist. His skill was to bring things together and to mix and match and to get everyone to work under the same cause. So he kind of always believed that he was a left-wing, anti-imperial, Muslim nationalist. But his defining feature as he took over the country that he helped to found was that he did not want to be aligned with either the Soviet Union or the United States. He thought the Third World was too big and important to have to. He thought that he could lead a new, not him personally, but he thought that the countries of the Third World could get together and forge their own destiny without being beholden to either of the superpowers.
And then he became a core of the whole non-aligned movement beginning in the 50s and 60s, right?
If not the most important figure driving its creation. So in 1955, he called the Afro-Asian Conference in Bandung, Indonesia, which was the predecessor to what grew into the non-aligned movement. And this was a hugely important movement for the countries of the Third World, Africa, Asia especially, but, you know, Brazil sent an advisor. And it was also something that the United States noticed and did not like. I mean, this was not the first thing that had worried them about how the way things were going in Indonesia. But when he kind of got on stage, even though he tried very almost pathetically to appeal to the American revolutionary sensibility by quoting Paul Revere at Bandung in 55, the United States didn't like it, and they started to think of ways to solve what they saw as a problem in Indonesia.
Was there a change in attitude from the Truman years to the Eisenhower years?
Yeah, absolutely. So the CIA was founded just after World War II, and in the Truman years, they largely tried to actually confront communism. These were liberal, elite, Yale-educated guys, and they were really eager to fight communism. A lot of them had come out of World War II. But in the actual communist Eastern Bloc, they failed over and over and horribly and repeatedly. They were sending people to their deaths in Albania. And then they turned to the Third World for a couple of reasons. Eisenhower didn't like the direct conflict of the Korean War, and he had no time for neutrality. So in 1953 and in 1954, the CIA overthrows governments in Iran and Guatemala. And this is seen as something that can really be really reproduced around the world. It's seen as a great, cheap, effective technology for, quote-unquote, fighting communism.
What happened that turned the Jakarta axiom into the Jakarta method?
The short answer is that the Communist Party kept winning elections. So the first attempt that the United States had to control the rise of the PKI, which is the first Communist Party founded in Asia, always a moderate, unarmed party, was to fund a conservative Islamist party. And that didn't work. The Communist Party kept doing better and better. And we know now from declassified files that the CIA recognized that the reason they were doing better and better was because they were sort of the best organized. They had the best outreach programs. They weren't as corrupt. U.S. officials recognized that they were doing sort of what you should do if you wanted to get people to vote for you. They kept performing better and better in elections. They changed tactics and they started coming up with all these underhanded schemes to either assassinate Sukarno or to ruin his reputation. And ultimately that culminated in 1958 with an actual CIA invasion of the country.
But we're not yet at the mass murders.
No, not at all. So that CIA invasion in 1958 fails, and it fails very obviously, and it embarrasses the United States because a pilot is caught. So for the next 6 years, the U.S. shifts tactics, and instead of directly confronting the military, they're training the military in Kansas. They're paying them very well, trying to get them to adopt what we might call the American ideology, or, you know, just to believe in the same things that the American foreign policy establishment believed in, while the ambassador, mostly successful during that time, convinced U.S. presidents that it was better just to kind of be friends with Sukarno. He wasn't a big problem. And that's how things went from 1958 to 1965, when everything really fell apart, not only because John F. Kennedy was killed and his approach was cast aside by President Johnson.
You mentioned the training of the Army. The U.S. bringing people from foreign armies for training here was a really crucial method of extending U.S. Power, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I mean, I kind of come to the conclusion that it was maybe the most effective thing that the United States ever did in the Cold War. I mean, if you look at the coups that came out of that tactic, the tactic of really sort of establishing ideological hegemony in the armed forces, those in the resulting regime stuck around for a long time. So Brazil in 1964 and Indonesia in 1965, the social orders put in place by those coups is basically intact now in both countries. Whereas if you look at the coups back in the 50s, when it was really more cowboy stuff and everybody knew who was doing it. I mean, if you were Iranian or Guatemalan, you knew it was the United States that overthrew your government. Those countries fell apart, you know, either very quickly in the case of Guatemala or, you know, a couple of decades later in the case of Iran. But absolutely, it was at least as important as the more direct conflicts that people tend to know about.
What happened that pushed things over from a toleration of Sukarno to we must get rid of this guy?
Yeah, so as I said, number one, JFK dies, and I think this might be one of the most important, I mean, for humanity, not for U.S. politics necessarily, but for humanity, this might be one of the most important long-term consequences of his death. LBJ just didn't have the time or patience to deal with it. He didn't really understand why Sukarno was making noises in the third world. He didn't want to defend aid to that country. And this starts to cause the deterioration of relations. Number two, Sukarno had been successful already twice in battling European colonial forces and winning. So he had got the Dutch out of his island initially, and then he battled internationally to get the Dutch out of Western Papua for a very long time. And on his third attempt to sort of go head-to-head with European colonial powers, he kind of bit off more than he could chew. So he told the world and the United Kingdom that the creation of Malaysia as they were doing it was unacceptable to him and could not be recognized. And even Western powers at the time understood that the UK was doing one of its kind of classic imperial tricks where they drew lines across the map in such a way to weaken their enemies. And Sukarno was right that they were doing that. But when he really made a fuss about this on the international stage, that's when tactics changed. And a reason for this was the UK itself. The UK put a lot of pressure on Johnson saying, look, you're vulnerable in Vietnam. You need our help. We need you to stand up to the Sukarno guy who's not letting us decolonize in the way that we want to. And so at the end of 1964, they remove the ambassador who has been a friend of Sukarno, and they bring in a guy who everybody knows is being brought in to do coups. He had done a coup in South Korea. It's clear what's happening. And we know now from declassified files that throughout 1964, 1965, U.S. and U.K. intelligence agencies were talking repeatedly that about the best of all possible options for them would be to create some kind of a clash between the Communist Party and the army. Because by this point, the Communist Party is 25 to 30% of the country, the largest Communist Party outside of the Soviet Union and China, but they don't have any guns and they don't have any ideological framework that would even allow them to tell their people to take up arms. I mean, they're clearly going to lose in a conflict with the army. And in the end of 1965, October 1st, we have this conflict. And what exactly causes this conflict is still mysterious. And the CIA has not declassified the documentation relating to its activities just before it. But it is quite notable, I think, that it is exactly what they asked for. You get a clash between the army and the PKI, even though the PKI may not have done anything at all, but in terms of the public discourse controlled by the military, this clash existed. And this clash was used as a pretext for the U.S.-backed army to execute approximately 1 million innocent civilians with the active assistance of the United States.
Yeah, there were, seven or eight dead generals, right, that sparked the crisis?
Yeah, so there was the September 30th movement, and there's as many theories about this as there are dead generals, if not many more. But what happened is that there was some low-level officers accused some high-level officers of planning a right-wing coup, attempted to kidnap them. They ended up dead. No one understands how or why they would have ended up dead. No one understands how or why they chose not to kidnap General Suharto, who was one of the most important right-wing generals. But this falls apart very quickly. Suharto takes control of the country, even though Sukarno is still the president. Suharto shuts down all of the radio and mass media, except for that which he controls. And he spreads this horrific, almost perfectly designed horror film version of communist evil throughout the country. And by spreading this propaganda story with the active assistance of U.S., U.K. media and intelligence services, he is able to have his army go out into the countryside and say, look, you need to help us kill the communists or we're going to kill you. And over the next 4 to 6 months, people start getting killed. And the reason it's possible to kill them, and this is sort of one of the hardest parts for me to go through when I was meeting all these survivors and I was spending a couple of years talking to the victims that I did, is that none of them had any idea that something like this could happen. They turned themselves in. They were very happy to go down to the station and give an interview. They had grown up being part of an Indonesia in which being a part of the Communist Party was just as normal as being, you know, in the Democratic Republic Party in the United States. But they went in and they never came out. And by the beginning of 1966, they had demolished the left in the country to an extent that Sukarno could be totally sidelined. Suharto could take over with U.S. backing and start to enjoy the status of one of Washington's most important Cold War allies. And this meant that U.S. corporations rolled in style. And, you know, there's some very sort of disgusting big events they throw as 1 million people are still in concentration camps purely for their political beliefs. And it also meant that there was aid given to Suharto, and also meant that the United States turned a blind eye to all of the other very horrible things that Suharto did over the next 30 years.
Yeah, but it created a favorable investment climate.
Yeah, right away.
I'm speaking with Vincent Bevins, author of The Jakarta Method, just out from Public Affairs Books. There's an interesting set of propaganda fantasies that Suharto's people created about the dead generals. They're like communist witches. Like evil women danced and castrated them, and mutilated their genitals. I mean, it was really a very strange gendered angle to the anti-communist mythology.
Yeah, absolutely. And for my book, I try to take sort of a global perspective and look at the anti-communist movement as an international thing rather than view it in its discrete parts. And these were mythologies that were developed across the world, and they kind of got traded around. You know, certain myths worked better, and certain horror stories really got people's blood boiling. But that's absolutely right. So right after he shut down all media that he did not control, he came out with this propaganda story, and it's too good for him to have made it up is the way that I would summarize academic consensus on this propaganda story. It came out of nowhere right away, and it spoke to a sort of deep insecurities in the Indonesian male, deep insecurities in the Muslim community. And to this day, the women that I met that were imprisoned or tortured or worse are still viewed as witches in Indonesia. They're still shunned from society. And a very important part of this right-wing coup that Suharto controlled was the destruction of the women's movement, which was at the time perhaps the most important and largest feminist organization. Well, the largest, who knows about most important, but the largest feminist organization in the world. And although they had nothing to do with this, he blamed the whole thing on them. He said that these women had a sort of torture sex orgy and castrated these heroic generals. And that was what he used to justify killing an innocent million people.
What exactly was the U.S. role in it? The U.S. did compile and supply lists of people to target, right?
Yes, exactly. So we know from end of 64 and all of 65, the U.S. had been covertly agitating for this kind of a clash. We don't know exactly how that agitation led to the clash. We know that as soon as it became clear what was happening, the new ambassador jumped on this and said in a cable to the United States, back to Washington, this is our chance. It's now or never. They helped Suharto spread this propaganda story. They supplied material equipment, weapons, communications equipment, medical equipment to help in the early days of the operation. Once the killings started, they got constant updates on the killings and made it very clear to the military elite as they were carrying out these killings that more killings would be useful to them. They made it very clear that they had to get rid of the support base for Sukarno in order to be recognized as the real government, in order to get the aid that they wanted. So the way that I summarize it is that they agitated for the conflict. They helped Suharto spread the propaganda that was necessary for the killing, and they encouraged the killing at every step of the way. Later, we do have one State Department official who comes out and says that he gave specific lists saying, kill this person, kill that person. But even that is only a fraction of the involvement. At many points, the United States is a prime mover in the massacre.
About the same time, halfway around the world, there was a coup in Brazil against Goulart, who is a mild reformer, not a communist, nothing that you would think should excite alarm, but he did, and he was deposed. What happened there?
He was a liberal reformer. He himself came from the elite, you know, as all Brazilian politicians basically have. And John F. Kennedy, in 1962, you can hear the recording of him saying this. He authorized his ambassador to let it be known among the military ranks that a coup would be welcome if that's what was needed. The main thing that he was going to do that really upset the elite was number one, land reform. And if you travel around the Amazon today, it's very obvious that there never was land reform. There is sort of still a post-feudal or even feudal system. And second was he wanted to give the vote to everyone, which is very resonant with what was happening in the United States at the exact same time. Brazil had a huge, formerly enslaved population that was effectively excluded from participating in democracy. And the elite was horrified by both of these prospects, by even liberal, moderate land reform, the kind of things that we oversaw very happily, we being the United States government, in South Korea and Japan. And the idea that they're going to give the vote to the full spectrum of Brazil's racial minorities. And so John F. Kennedy sent in a military attaché, Vernon Walters. And lo and behold, 2 years later, the new president is his former roommate. They had lived together in Italy back in the 40s. Again, the United States was not setting off bombs and flying planes over Brazil as they were in Iran, in Guatemala. It was more of that they had laid the deep roots for the elite to take power in sort of a more organic way.
After the coup in Brazil, there was not the same kind of bloodletting that there was in Indonesia. But the Brazilians did spread the model elsewhere in Latin America, is that right?
Yeah, exactly. So from 1964 to 1968, there was no terror in Brazil. In 1965 or 1968, you get a hard right turn, and you do start seeing disappearances and murders in Brazil, but only in the hundreds, not in the tens of thousands like you saw elsewhere in South America. But the Brazil military dictatorship was seen as a model for the Latin American right and by U.S. officials as a way to fight, quote-unquote, communism in South America. So when Salvador Allende takes over in 1970, the Brazilian military is very actively participating in preparations for a coup in Chile. They're there in the famous Chilean National Stadium when Pinochet takes over, and that becomes a torture and execution center. Brazil played a huge role in South America's Cold War that is often forgotten because they fall away after Pinochet and the Central American death squads become the real headline grabbers. But it was definitely the first domino, if we're going to sort of invert that domino theory. It was the big giant right-wing dictatorship which inspired so many others. And they also were actively involved in Uruguay and Bolivia in making sure right-wing coups happened.
To return to the theme of the book, there were graffiti in Chile saying Jakarta is coming when Allende was president, and that was designed to spread fear. People would get postcards saying Jakarta is coming. So that idea of Jakarta had such a great propagandistic and imaginative power for people.
Yeah, and the sort of terrible thing to realize is that Jakarta, as a shorthand for the mass extermination of the left, really worked in Indonesia. And other U.S. allied far-right movements around the world saw this huge success and sought to either reproduce it or draw inspiration from it. So in 1972, in exactly that moment when Brazil and Chile are collaborating to find a way to get rid of Allende, Jakarta pops up in both countries as shorthand for exactly that. So in Brazil, you get Operação Jakarta, which is an ultimately abortive program to kill communists here, although they killed a very important and beloved man, which caused big problems for them unexpectedly. And then in Chile, you had right-wing terrorists going around to the houses of socialists or supporters of the country saying Jakarta's coming. And that message was very clear. It meant we're going to kill you. And unfortunately, Jakarta came. A lot of the people that had been threatened in that way were killed soon after. And we spent some time trying to track down exactly how this got to Chile, who would have done it. But the main point, I think, is that this tactic, the intentional murder of innocent civilians, was such a big part of the way that our side ultimately won that I think you have to see it as a fundamental part of the world that it ended up creating. That, you know, I found at least 20 countries where something like this happened. In some way or another, about half of them you could link to Jakarta, you know, linguistically, but certainly they all were looking around and noticing, okay, you can do that. They did that. You can get away with it. Let's do that here. We're obviously going to get away with it here. We heard that, you know, in Indonesia, they disappeared people, which causes more fear among the families. And that means that people don't fight back. So maybe we could do sort of something similar in Latin America. And I think you have to sort of view this as a global network, which is unfortunately a really important part of what shaped the final outcome of the Cold War.
You cite Nixon, and I guess Kissinger shared this point of view, as being afraid that Allende would be successful. I mean, it didn't seem like they really believed fully in the communist threat, but the real threat was that the kind of reformist democratic socialism that Allende represented would have powerful appeal to people elsewhere, and that's what had to be stopped. Is that was the issue?
Yeah, that's what he said. We know that he said that. He said that the real problem would be a success in Chile, and a lot of times now, even down here in South America, the right wing will say, Allende messed up the economy and that's why. Well, no. U.S.-backed right-wing terror started before he took office. And we also know that they wanted him to become more dictatorial because that would make it easier for them to justify a takeover. The biggest fear would be the demonstration effect. And in the case of Guatemala in 1954, we also know how declassified documentation indicating it was the same thing. We can read them saying, we know Guatemala is not a threat. We know that there's no communists here. But what if they give everybody else ideas? What if they succeed in redistributing some of the land in a way which allows for the creation of an effective capitalist economy, which was all that Jacobo Arbenz wanted? Everybody else is going to stand up to us. This is, you'll agree, that not the side of the Cold War that gets reproduced often in the mainstream media, which is where I worked, you know, most of my career. But I mean, whether we like it or not, that's what they said. I mean, that's how they understood it.
Yeah, so, I mean, when they talk about communism, they're perhaps not talking about, you know, Lenin and the hammer and sickle, but they are talking about something that represented a threat to American political power and also American economic power. These are countries that were trying to step, in some sense, out of the hierarchy in which Washington and Wall Street were at the top of.
Yeah, I mean, a new global system was being born. The United States was clearly the leader of and the driving force in that global system. And three separate things can combine or independently convince the men constructing this global system that something's wrong. I think these men really were opposed to communism. They thought it was evil. They thought they were fighting it. And if they saw anything that looked like that, that could convince them they had to do something. Something else that could convince them they had to do something was if very powerful corporations in the United States leaned on them because, for example, my fruit company in Guatemala is in trouble, or in Indonesia, oil was quite important. That, to them, I think was synonymous with opposition to the global order. They were forces that combined very well. And the third is that the actual opposition to the system itself, whether or not it was communism on its own, somebody standing up and saying, this is not the system that I want to be part of. Well, let's do this differently, whether it is reorganizing the third world so that they can stop being forced to depend on the export of raw materials and upgrade their manufacturing capabilities, or just to say, no, we want to do a certain kind of land reform that's not the land reform you're telling us. It was seen as the same kind of a threat to what to the American policymakers seemed a very natural and benevolent creation of a global order. And in that global order, I mean, I think it's the global order we inhabit now. I think that they won. I think that they were successful. But I think that there was a lot of ways to set off their alarms. And if you set off one, they might do something. If you set off two, they're really probably going to do something. And if it's all three, if they're standing up to you and there's U.S. corporations involved and there's a communist party somewhere that you can point to, you didn't have good chances.
So where is this all now? I mean, we see Trump, what looks like undermining the pillars of the post-World War II global order, not terribly interested in all the kinds of classic foreign policy pursuits that his predecessors were interested in. They've been unable to overthrow Maduro, despite repeated and pathetic attempts.
Right.
In Brazil, you've got Bolsonaro, who is in many ways an heir to that coup, but not a very effective figure in lots of ways. So where is this system now? Is this like just finally running out of gas or what?
I think we're definitely running out of gas. The question is what happens at that point, right? Because, you know, if the hegemon is in decline, which I think everybody recognizes that the hegemon is in decline, whether or not they think it's a good thing, there's a lot of ways that could go, right? I mean, I don't know what happens if other nations take more power there. I don't know if the hegemon gets irresponsibly panicked about its decline and then lashes out and means that there is no global system for a while. But I do know that we're at a crossroads, and we're not going to know which way to go if we don't know where we already are. And to know where we are, I think we have to understand the violence that constituted the system that we currently inhabit in order to decide whether or not we want to fight at all costs to keep it and whether or not it's even possible to keep it. I think we have to understand exactly what built it.
That was Vincent Bevins, author of The Jakarta Method from Public Affairs Books. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. And in the playoffs, 1851, a banner for the playboy in the Cuban sun. For Castro is the color, is the redder than red. But Washington bullets one Castro dead. Castro is the color. The whole news playoff led. Washington, what else could you do? That was from Washington Bullets by The Clash, a song Vincent Bevins quotes in his book. Next, schooling in the hellscape. What is going on with education now that most of it is happening remotely? How does it reflect all the problems of the system before the crisis? And how might we emerge from it better? Here to address those questions is Kyle Beckham. Kyle Beckham has a doctorate in education from Stanford and is a lecturer at the University of San Francisco's College of Education. Kyle Beckham. Tell me what it's been like to teach under these preposterous circumstances.
I have this spectrum. I had classes that started after COVID had begun, and I had classes that had begun kind of at the beginning of the year. And those that had to transition into this online format, it's been utterly brutal. And it's heightened a lot of the contradictions that existed within. I'm in higher ed, but I also work in teacher education. So just getting reports from my students in teacher ed and seeing what it's done to their students, what it's done to them as teachers. And then for myself, it's been borderline unmanageable with having to go from having childcare to providing childcare, from having a relative amount of distance from my students to going into full support mode. So the mental and emotional taxation that teaching normally brings has been intensified to levels that, I haven't experienced since I was a first-year teacher teaching in East Oakland.
There are aspects of teaching that are kind of like being a shrink. How's their mental health?
Overall, I would say it's pretty awful. They're doing the best that they can, given the circumstances, but I teach some early childhood educators, and many of them have their own kids, and they're non-traditional students. I have grandmothers, and it's mainly women, and a lot of them just, they would not have signed up for the kind of classroom experience that they've had, and because of that, like, the amount of stress and pressure that they're under is just, it's unbelievable. And the mental aspects of it have just been brutal. I have students who, like earlier today, I just received an email from a student who had gone MIA, and I had kind of sent out a blanket, if you need to take an incomplete, let's email me. And she was one of many who needed this because their lives were turned upside down and they couldn't access any of those social supports that otherwise would have gotten them through this.
Are administrators expecting too much of students under these circumstances?
In the higher ed level, I think that they don't know what to make in terms of expectations for students. I think that a lot of them are like, it's unrealistic, but they had no plan for this. So I think a lot of them are retreating into, well, let's kind of get some type of normal back. And I think that they were frequently out of touch with what normal required for many students, particularly students who are not traditional students. I think that that's been devastating. Instead of saying, like, what we need to be doing is taking a pause on all of this, a pause on normal, and that we need to be focusing on essentially managing this collapse so that it doesn't devastate students. And I think that rhetorically a lot of administrators would say that, but in terms of the responses, I don't really see it. Like, it's very catch as catch can, very ad hoc in terms of what they are expecting. And because of the nature in higher ed of, like, the instructors having pretty significant autonomy about how classroom experience unfolds, that many professors who probably weren't very good to begin with and who kind of have very anti-human approaches to teaching, I have students that said that they have expectations ramped up, that the pressure has been turned up, that their instructors want more of them often than what existed before, which I think is a function of lack of top-end leadership.
That's completely insane to expect more. How could that possibly be done? That's beyond human capacity.
Well, I think that that's what we're starting to see, is that a lot of these kind of subtle hidden expectations and technologies of control that existed in individual classroom spaces that's what teachers know. And instructors, particularly in the higher ed, who don't have, they've never been trained on how to teach. So they are just ad hoc-ing it. And, there's narratives of what the students need is structure, and what they need is higher expectations. And maybe at some point, on some level, sure. But I think that there's just a general disconnect between what a lot of instructors and I won't say this is a majority, right, but enough to where it creates problems across any student's schooling experience where they are completely disconnected from the reality of what it means to be a student.
My kid's in eighth grade in a public school in New York City, but it's a very progressive public school, and they've required maybe an hour or so of class work a day, remote class work, and maybe a little bit of homework, maybe half an hour, 45 minutes. So it's really not more than 2 hours a day they expect out of him. And, you know, he's having not a great time of it, but he's getting by. But it seems I've heard of stories of kids, middle school kids, being expected to be in front of the computer from 9 to 3. And then do a normal amount of homework. I mean, what's your impression of what the practice is around the country in this?
So, again, you're going to get that spectrum because of the intense localism in how American schools are structured. And, you know, I've heard reports of teachers and schools having dress codes for students online, which is, I mean, we can laugh about it, but it reflects a general approach that some of these schools have towards the teacher-student-student-school relationship. And I really think that there's a willingness on schools, an enthusiasm in some schools, to intrude into the homes of their students. And this has, you know, it's always existed. That's what homework is. But now it's just been radically intensified. But then on the other side, you have progressive teachers who are trying to meet this humanely, who are trying to involve their students in what imagining different, giving these really profound constraints means. And there's this duality of the constraint, but also I think for radical and progressive teachers, there's an intense amount of possibility. And that, like, you can now do a lot of the things that you may have thought you couldn't do. You know, you can make your space extremely student-centered. You can make every session about the reality that the kids are experiencing.
If you're in charge of things, what would it be a better way of structuring this under the present circumstances?
Well, so what I would like to see is that just a deprioritizing of academics generally in favor of community building in terms of thinking about how can we involve students in envisioning what school should, could, and is, like the envisioning the possible, but also being very aware of the present. And it's an opportunity for us to make this student-centered.
Well, what would that look like more specifically?
Oh, so more specifically, like, I think that it would be, let's take just your typical district, that district saying to school sites, like, we'd like to see, you know, you have a plan for legitimate student support, you know, involving communities in this, not necessarily privileging the totality of this online modality and recognizing that there's extreme limits and problems with it, and that giving a general pause, I think, would be really useful. Like, let's pause the normal functioning of schools. Let's sit down as school communities and networks of schools and think about what was happening before that could and should be discarded, what could and should be, that was positive in schools that needs to be amplified, and then how do we reconnect kids and families who've been completely disconnected from schools by this, who may not have the capacity to get online, who may not have the desire to be online. How can we involve them in kind of the creation of something new? And I think that would require a shift on the administrative level that, you know, that's pie in the sky in a lot of ways without some substantial organizing, which is another thing that I think this is a huge opportunity for teachers and networks of teachers across the K-20 spectrum to be thinking about. How can we claw back some control that we have kind of ceded to market forces, to managerial forces, to, you know, the kind of atomized, highly competitive schooling that is the dominant form.
Yeah. What are the problems that you're discussing about the current situation? How are those tied to problems of more normal times, the kinds of marketized, test-oriented, all that stuff? The problems of the current moment emerge from that model, don't they?
Right. So I think what this is also intensifying and bringing to the forefront is the nature of control in schools and how schools, you know, are frequently highly you know, there are institutions where students are to be controlled. These new technologies of surveillance are emerging in this moment that I think are really frightening, and that there's a double edge to this online, I don't like calling it online learning, it's more online schooling. And so we need to be really investigating what schooling looked like for most kids. And for most kids, it's a pretty outside of the social functions of them being around same age peers and having friends and relationship stuff, that school is often a really forgettable experience. And this, again, is intensifying that, because the control aspect is for teachers to, like, give busy work to students and families, thinking that that helps to give kind of meaningless exercises in compliance. And these are the contradictions that I think were playing out and have played out for over 100 years in American schools. They're intensifying now. And I think also in terms of the marketizing and privatizing side, that in states and localities that have weak, poorly organized teachers, you're going to see the vultures and hucksters emerge, where they're going to sell teacher-proof curricula, and that will be used as ways to purge the workforce, to increase teacher workloads, to justify an intensification of the deprofessionalization of teaching, which is a project that has been ongoing since mass schools emerged, is the attempts to teacher-proof the classroom. They generally fail, but I think this is seen again on the side of the privatizing, marketizing reform movement, that it's an opportunity to kind of breathe some life into that.
I'm speaking with the educator Kyle Beckham. We've got Governor Cuomo in New York bringing in Bill Gates and Eric Schmidt to reimagine education in the state. What do you think they have up their sleeves? What kind of schemes will emerge from this crisis?
Well, given Bill Gates' track record, it's really it's kind of laughable how his pattern of failure is pretty significant. He's done all kinds of pet projects. He's spent hundreds of millions, billions of dollars on things. None of them have stuck. Yet, like, with this persistent pattern of failure, his inability to change the broader system. You know, I think we're going to get more of this ad hoc attempts to, I don't think he knows at this point. It's just that he's been elevated to some kind of visionary status in a field where he has failed tremendously. But because he's a guru, he's some kind of business genius, that he has something to offer schools and teaching. I mean, I jokingly say to people, it's tantamount to bringing teachers in to run Microsoft. Microsoft wouldn't take that seriously. But, you know, there's this belief that because people have been to school and some people have spent some time thinking about it, that, you know, if you have a lot of money, you can make people listen to you. He'll probably do some stuff around curriculum. That's his new hobby horse, the redoing the curriculum. There'll be some attempt to kind of standardize, future orient the curriculum. Nothing new. But it will just have the kind of Bill Gates stamp on it, and everyone will think that it's some kind of genius project. It won't have teacher buy-in. It won't have community buy-in. It'll be the top-down technocratic stuff that he's always tried, and I don't think it'll, you know, it may stick here and there, but it's not going to be any kind of system-level change that I think that someone like Cuomo thinks it will be. Same with Schmidt and the Googlers. These are people who are, you know, I'm not going to say they're not smart people, but I think they really misunderstand what schools are as organizations, as ecologies. And any attempt to teacher-proof or teacher-minimize really misunderstands kind of the way that policy in schools works.
Well, what about replacing teachers with iPads, or I guess in Gates' case, it would be a Surface?
Larry Cuban has extensive history of technology in the classroom. And people have been promising these revolutionary changes via electronic technology for, you know, ever since electronic technology became a thing. And, you know, one need only look at Los Angeles and the iPad fiasco there to think that iPads are going to solve things, or that kids are digital natives. There's all kinds of magical thinking that goes into thinking that, you know, that this device is going to somehow change the way that social relations of school operate. And kids are really smart, and they will thwart these things, especially if they're used to control rather than give the students kind of control over the learning. And rarely are these things done in ways to give students meaningful control and say in how schools operate. It's just kind of like this belief that if we put them in the ocean of information, that magical things are going to happen. And it mystifies what happens in the classroom.
Education is a profoundly social thing, and they seem to want to replace it with machines.
Right. And most of the attempts at this at scale fail pretty profoundly just because, you know, there's just so much wishful thinking in this that, you know, if we give everyone a computer, that somehow this magical stuff is just going to happen. And, you know, no one talks about the legacy costs of this or how when the computer breaks, who has to fix it. And these are all real serious problems with this shift into believing that high technology is what's going to fix schools. And, you know, the presumption that all schools are somehow broken is another, you know, like really pernicious, dangerous, nasty myth that empowers all kinds of wild experimentation that people will allow these intrusions into schools that, you know, it's a lot of these harebrained schemes of wanting to shortcut your way to a particular kind of change, of being able to say that Americans are number one in the international comparative tests. Like, so great. What if we are number one? I mean, students in Massachusetts as a state test some of the best. They're among the best in the world, but we don't hear that as a narrative. We don't say Massachusetts schools are phenomenal. They're some of the best in the world. We just hear American schools are failing.
Yeah, well, there's that polling paradox. People love their own schools, love their kids' schools, but say the system is broken. What's going on there? They just hear it so much they believe it?
Well, there's a direct historical antecedent. I mean, there's always been declension narratives, but this is something it parallels the Reagan Revolution that you start to see in the late 70s, early 80s, a real belief in American schools declining, and that conservatives really pushing some return to an American school system. There's never been a coherent single American school system that is this kind of back to basics thing. And the culmination of that rhetorical shift is the 1983 Nation at Risk report, which really kind of set the stage of American schools are causal in some American decline. And that the reason why the Japanese have lean manufacturing is because, and can outperform us in manufacturing, is because American schools are somehow failing to produce workers or whatever. And these are old narratives, but this general divestment in a belief in government as useful, as government as competent, you start to see that in the polling begins to shift in the early 80s. You know, there's a lot of this belief that much of the experimentation and radical stuff that was happening in schools in the 60s and 70s was excessive. And because of that, it was leading to American decline, and it really took root. And the belief, Trent, that 1983 moment of we're falling apart because of American schools leads to the standards movement, leads to charters becoming this market force thing, that competition is what is going to drive us forward. But, schools are reflective entities. They're not superordinate entities. They're subordinate entities. They kind of reflect what's going on in American society. And so in the 50s and 60s, Americans really loved American schools generally. By the 90s, people think that American schools are garbage, even though if you look at, like, test scores and things like that, there wasn't this decline. So even on its own metrics, the narrative doesn't work.
So is there anything good that could come out of the current moment?
I mean, I think lots of good can come out of the current moment. I think that teachers who organize can really take advantage of being able to, like I was saying earlier, to build with their students, to build with their parents, to form bonds and avenues of communication that were much harder before in a lot of ways. And because of, like, the disruption to higher ed, too, there's this ambiguity about, like, grades now. And there's conversations about grades and sorting and ranking and why are we doing this that I don't think it's definitely not been at the forefront in the ways that it is now. I think that there is a lot of radical educators have kind of wanted this space where there's so much possibility to make schools something else. And, you know, administrators and all of the other kind of top end, they're completely on the back foot. And, I think teachers and school communities properly organized can really potentially, you know, it's not a given and it requires a lot of hard work and grind, really start to turn schools into the places that we want them to be. And that if we, you know, if and when we return to in-person schooling, like having maybe thought out a lot of this stuff. And I think it's also a really important moment for us to be saying no to things. And that's in a lot of ways very positive. No to AP tests, which just happened the other day when this catastrophe of thousands and thousands of people having their AP tests invalidated because of technical problems in the system. And saying no to that, saying no, like standardized tests across the country just stopped. And that's really profound. And we can really say, well, we don't need these anymore. What good are they? And a lot of these contradictions and a lot of the just normal hegemonic functions of schooling have stopped. And we can potentially really make something new, make something better, make something humane, make something that will potentially help students become more politically engaged, more socially engaged. It doesn't have to be this atomizing, disconnected, anti-human experience. And it feels that way because that's what schools were for so many kids and teachers before this.
That was Kyle Beckham, a former public school teacher who is now a lecturer at the University of San Francisco's College of Education. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of an anti-school anthem, I mostly mean ironically, from Pink Floyd. Till next week, bye.